I'm Robin Young. It's here and now, and we start today with news from JetBlue, which is promising to pay passengers for their lost time. The company unveiled its customer bill of rights, offering flyers travel vouchers ranging from $25 to a free round-trip ticket when their flights are delayed or canceled. JetBlue is trying to repair its tarnished image after canceling about 1,100 flights in the wake of a snowstorm last week. And CEO David Neeleman said passengers would be paid retroactively for last week's delay. That alone could cost JetBlue up to $30 million. Well, Doug Cameron is airline industry correspondent for the Financial Times. Doug, tell us exactly what JetBlue is going to offer in terms of payback.
They've outlined today a range of compensations, which can go anything from a $25 voucher if you're stuck on the ground waiting for the plane for 1 to 2 hours, to a full refund if you're stuck for 4 to 6 hours.
It goes in increments. Delayed 30 to 60 minutes is a $25 voucher, delayed 1 to 2 hours, $100 voucher, and so on.
Exactly. So in theory, customers can look at their watches and tick off the money they're earning while they're delayed. But I think a key issue for JetBlue and any other airline that might look at this is actually how you administer and implement it. It could be a very complex formula trying to attribute who's actually to blame for the delay.
Well, I was going to say, because there is something listed, if a flight is canceled within 12 hours of scheduled departure, and it is a situation within the control of the company as opposed to weather or airport delays. So that would seem to be where the debate might come.
Absolutely. If you look at the industry data from the Department of Transportation, it roughly breaks down that two-thirds of delays in the U.S. airline industry are down to the aging, as the airlines would say, air traffic control infrastructure. Most of the rest of it is down to weather. So that only actually leaves a very small amount that it could potentially be attributed to the airline itself.
It also says JetBlue will take the necessary action to deplane customers if the aircraft is ground delayed for 5 hours. You know, some people might say, well, that's certainly, you know, better than waiting 10 or 11 hours, but 5 may still be too much for many people. What does JetBlue have to consider to let people off the plane?
Well, what they say is that the captains will be given full discretion as to when to deplane. The problem often is that if the plane has left the gate, they have to find a free gate to get back, or they have to find the buses. 5 hours does sound like a long time, but I guess it's a little bit better than the 8 hours which some suffered.
And by the way, brief reminder, why was JetBlue hit so hard by that snowstorm last week?
There's two things with JetBlue. It, unlike most other carriers in the U.S., operates point-to-point traffic. A plane just goes between New York and Syracuse, for example, as opposed to then going on to Houston or Chicago in the way that many other airlines with hub-and-spoke systems do. So JetBlue operates a little bit more like a bus service, where the airlines ply single routes. That means they've been willing to wait for weather to clear. That's why they suffered so hard. Mm-hmm. Other airlines with hub-and-spokes cancel earlier because they know that the weather can have a knock-on effect throughout their system.
Well, some say JetBlue's new Bill of Rights is an end run around Congress, because Congress was considering its own passengers' Bill of Rights. And the EU passed its own customer Bill of Rights in 2005, wherein airlines would be forced to pay customers up to €600 for canceled flights. Now, the industry initially said the rules would cost about $700 million a year. That hasn't happened. So what happened there? And has JetBlue maybe observed that?
I think what you would say about the European version is that it's unpopular in just about every quarter. As far as the airlines are concerned, they would argue the regulators don't understand the complexities of the airline business, and in fact, this passenger bill of rights can actually lead to greater delays as some airlines try to cut their losses. For the passengers, it's also seen as unpopular because they accuse the airlines of exploiting loopholes and the nuances of what represents a delay or a cancellation, which, a bit like JetBlue, is proposing there is a sliding scale of payments depending on the type of delay or cancellation. So it's not been a very popular policy in the EU, to be honest, and it's also proven to be a bit of a nightmare to implement.
What is your sense, then, of JetBlue's proposal?
JetBlue had no choice but to do this. It's been such both a public relations disaster for a service-based business. There wasn't much they could do except this. I expect that it will not be followed by other airlines in the industry. There will be lots of political noise about this, but to be honest, as far as delays and customer inconvenience is concerned, the problems with air traffic control and airport congestion are in fact far more endemic than the impact of a big storm.
Doug Cameron, airline industry correspondent for the Financial Times. Doug, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
We recently had an extended conversation with an African-American Salon.com columnist, Deborah Dickerson. This was right after the uproar over Senator Joe Biden's comment that Barack Obama was articulate, a word that many blacks read as meaning articulate for his race. Well, Deborah took that debate a bit further. Her premise was that many African-Americans don't even call Barack Obama black because, as the son of a Kenyan and a white woman from Kansas, he does not embody the black American history of slavery or their fight for civil rights. And she said that white Americans embrace Obama precisely because he doesn't remind them of those painful issues. But she said their embrace of him doesn't extend to her and doesn't let whites off the hook of that painful past. Well, Deborah Dickerson hit a nerve, to put it mildly, and as promised, we want to air some of your thoughts. Mark Miller of Bozeman, Montana writes, "I'm not on any hook. Like many whites, my family fought racism since the Civil War. I don't want my heritage waived by superficial views of race any more than Dickerson does." Janelle Myers of Sag Harbor, New York adds, "I am shaking so hard with frustration and anger I can hardly type. As a white person who lives in a black neighborhood and has been active in the civil rights movement, I am outraged at this woman." Gregory Brewer writes, "I am a black American. The idea that because someone's family doesn't come from a certain part of Africa that they are not black is the same type of crap that keeps us down. We ourselves are our limiting factor," Gregory adds. And then Jack Drury of Waltham, Massachusetts called us.
"As an African-American who grew up radicalized in the late 60s, early 70s in college, it was the first time that I ever thought about Barack not being one of us. I don't consider him not to be one of us. No one has a right to say that Barack doesn't represent us. Someone can say Barack doesn't represent me, but no one has a right to speak for all African-Americans and say that Barack Obama is not one of us."
Well, black, white, mixed race, we heard from you, and we want to hear more. With Melissa Harris-Lacewell, she's Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University. Professor, first of all, what do you think about this conversation?
I guess my first thought about this conversation is that in a certain way, you know, as an academic, I find it good. It's an opportunity for us to air differences and have a conversation about race. Now, that said, I do think that Dickerson is wrong. I think that she's wrong both to suggest that there is a broad belief that Barack Obama is not one of us, and I think she's particularly wrong to root that belief, to the extent that it does exist, in some notion of his racial parentage. To the extent that there is concern about Barack Obama as a African-American leader, that concern emerges out of some suspense about Barack's policy positions. It is not about him having a white mother and a Kenyan father.
Melissa, Stanley Crouch agrees with Deborah Dickerson. He says, "When black Americans say Obama is one of us, I don't know what they're talking about. He hasn't lived the life of black Americans." And is this, you know, either a debate or a conversation that's going on in academic circles?
Well, it's certainly a conversation going on in academic circles. So two things I would say. One, the reason I'm a social scientist and each of these individuals is a journalist is because they can apparently take their personal opinions and experiences and translate onto all of black America. I, on the other hand, am a quantitative researcher who has to have evidence about other people's opinions from other people. So given that Barack Obama has been elected by a predominantly African-American population over and over again to the Illinois Senate, and then was elected by a substantial African-American population to the U.S. Senate, the notion that he does not represent us is bizarre. He was my state senator and then my actual senator until I moved here to Illinois. And in both cases, he certainly represented me.
So what do you think is going on here? I want to say that we heard from three categories of listeners as we define them. White, who, as we heard, were insulted at the notion that they couldn't not be racist. And then we also heard from blacks, many of them who are also mixed race, who were insulted that they could not be considered black. But we did hear from both whites and blacks in a very powerful category who said that they felt that there was a group of African Americans who were self-segregating, who were defining themselves by their history and who were not able to move on from that.
Well, I mean, that's interesting and might map well enough onto the electorate. I mean, certainly there are, among white voters, there are actively anti-racist voters who are interested in supporting a black candidate in part because they would like to see a more diverse political leadership. There's a group of racist white voters who under no circumstances are going to vote for a candidate of color. And to imagine that that group doesn't exist is equally sort of blind as to imagine that the anti-racist group does not exist. So both of those groups of white voters exist. And then there's a whole group who are trying not to think about race at all and trying to just think about Barack Obama and all the other candidates individually as candidates. Now, for African-American voters, again, shockingly, not all black people think alike. It turns out there are vast differences among black voters as well. So again, you'll have a population who will want to support Barack because he's black and because having a black leader is more important than any questions of policy. There will be a group of African American voters who will only support Barack if they find that he is a progressive policy leader in addition to being racially black. And then there's a group of African Americans, particularly African American political leadership. And that leadership has largely been able to sustain itself politically by making a claim towards representing a unitary black political agenda. And they're going to have a lot of anxiety about any member of the African American race who's able to emerge in politics and be embraced by white media and white institutions. It's not so much that Barack Obama's policies are not progressive. They are. But he's embraced by institutions which have traditionally not embraced black people and black interest. I have no idea what self-segregation means. Segregation was a law, actually a set of laws imposed by U.S. states on African American citizens. And here's the deal. At any point in American history, before 1965, Barack Obama would have been enslavable in the U.S. South, and then he would have been subject to Jim Crow laws in the U.S. South. He would have been subject to restricted covenants. He is certainly black enough for white racist policies that prevailed for most of American history.
Well,
makes him black enough for me.
Well, we want to give you a chance to hear for yourself what some of our listeners, white and black, say themselves they meant by self-segregation on the part of blacks. They accuse Deborah Dickerson and other African Americans of making the past their identity, of viewing all whites as a monolith. So we want to hear your thoughts on that. Melissa Harris-Lacewell is Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton. When we come back with her, we'll have more of your letters. And don't forget, later in the program, Ira Glass on Going From Radio to TV. Just a quick reminder of that. Back after the break, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Melissa Harris-Lacewell, Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University, and with more of your thoughts about comments made by a previous guest, Salon.com columnist Deborah Dickerson. Now, there were some of you who agreed with Deborah's point that many whites were embracing Senator Barack Obama because he didn't reflect slavery or the civil rights battle. He was exotic, as one of you put it. But outside of that, those of you who disagreed with Dickerson fell into three categories, as I said. The first, whites. Justin Perkins wrote, "I am confused. I'm 29. What does Dickerson want from me? Honestly, I'm at a loss. What penance do whites owe blacks? Most of the whites in the U.S. have little to do with past injustice." Krista Reinhart from Malvern, Pennsylvania writes, "I'm 50 and white, and I have no idea what black America expects from me. If only black America can move away from their obsession with racism." Professor Lacewell, these are people who say, you think we're all racist, and we're not. I like Obama for what he stands for. Your thoughts?
I think we have failed fundamentally in our way of talking about and teaching about race and racism. So I think that it's legitimate for white voters and citizens to say, hey, in my heart, I don't harbor any negative feelings or emotions about race. And what I can say as a researcher is, that's terrific. But it turns out that even if we wiped away every single prejudiced feeling in every single white person in all of the world, we would still have enormous racial inequality, which has emerged from a set of structures and history that have over and over again benefited whites over persons of color.
I want to move on to the second category of people of mixed race. Ted Ndedi writes, I'm also the child of a Kenyan father, in his case, an African-American mother. But how does this make me less black? Whether you're from Africa or South America, you still get the N-word hurled at you. He goes on, all too often, we African-Americans do so much to undo our own successes by keeping it real. Renu Egelhart is a mixed race. He writes, issues on the state and federal level affect all of us. So what happens to those of us who, like Obama, our families came here after the Civil War and took no part in American's slave legacy? Are our voices discounted?
Your listener is correct in saying that race can transcend boundaries of, country of origin. If we think about, for example, Amadou Diallo, who is murdered by the New York Police Department, who of course is a black immigrant, who is not part of the history of Southern American slavery, and yet the community in the city of New York rallied around Diallo and Diallo's family and very much presented him as a black man who'd been shot by white police officers. So I think this notion that, black skinnedness or, regardless of one's parental heritage still sends you into the American experience of race is a key and important point.
Well, we heard from one white listener, David Bean of Arlington, Massachusetts, who fully agreed with Deborah Dickerson. He says, the stigma of American blacks doesn't derive so much from their skin colors, from the humiliating history of slavery. Many light-colored African-Americans, the descendants of slaves, have been shunned by whites who are happy to treat Africans and West Indians with greater respect.
It's not clear to me that there is evidence that West Indians and Africans are treated with greater respect. It is true that, again, at any point during the history of American slavery, they would have been enslavable in the U.S. South, and during Jim Crow, they would have been subject to Jim Crow laws. So this notion of kind of interpersonal respect falls deaf for me because, relative to law, to codification, to the power of the state, African Americans from the African diaspora, sort of from all over the world. The other thing is that some of our greatest leaders, some of them that we hold up, have been either of mixed race heritage or of immigrant background. Marcus Garvey led the largest 20th century movement of African Americans in the United States, and he was West Indian.
But do you think the whites are more attracted to African Americans? They somehow can tell that they, what their background is? I mean, that was my question to Deborah Dickerson, because it's assuming that whites can tell.
Well, I think that certainly whites can tell when people speak with accented language.
Well, sure, but right? Outside of that,
the way to think of this is Barack Obama's blackness is not necessarily any more forgivable among whites than the blackness of, say, a Jesse Jackson, simply because he has a white mother and an African father. In fact, I expect that what is likely to happen over the course of the next 6 months to a year is that we are going to see Barack Obama's race increasingly become part of the public narrative around him, so that it becomes the defining characteristic. Even now, we haven't talked about his position on Iraq. We haven't talked about his position on health care. We have not discussed the work that he's done in communities. We just keep talking about how black he is or isn't.
I want to get to the last category, white and black listeners who said, yes, as a matter of fact, I do embrace Barack Obama precisely because he is not the old guard. Andy Wood of Bedford, Mass. writes, the old guard is the woe is me guard. The best thing I heard during your interview was Dickerson being appalled by how little young people know about slavery. Thank God the young people are finally moving on. And Richard Wright writes, I am an African-American PhD. I refuse to live my life with race at the center.
I, too, am an African-American PhD. race is not all of who I am. I'm a mom, I'm a runner, you know, I'm a teacher. But if I were to delude myself into imagining that race is not always a central part of how others react to me and how I understand myself in the world, and why we have to imagine that that's a bad thing, that is, I think, potentially empowering, important. It roots one historically. And in the end, Barack Obama is a candidate. And I think, you know, if we look very closely at Barack Obama's voting record, we will find something not so far away from the old guard. He is very interested in the ways in which the power of government can be harnessed to make life better for individual citizens. And I think ultimately that's most of what Black America has been interested in from about 1860 forward.
Melissa Harris Lacewell, Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University. Just delightful talking to you, and we'll have to do it again because obviously this is something people are just dying to talk about.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much.
Sure.
And to hear the original conversation that sparked your letters, go to our website, here-now.org. Quick note about tomorrow, actor Danny Glover will be here to tell us about his new movie in which peasants from Mali take on the World Bank. That's tomorrow. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A new study says Americans shouldn't fret about retirement. The University of Wisconsin study found that 80% of people born between 1931 and 1941 have enough money for retirement. What? Why are we constantly being told to save? We want to spend some time on this with Boston University economics professor Zvi Bodie, who has some controversial ideas about this. He says people aren't only on track, they're saving too much money. They should prepare themselves to work into old age. Well, Professor Bodie, your colleague Lawrence Kotlikoff started this debate when he said Americans were over-saving. We think financial advisors like Susie Orman would go crazy at this. So you think really Americans are saving too much?
I think Larry Kotlikoff has been misquoted. What he has said to me on various occasions is that if you follow the advice of, say, a Vanguard or a Fidelity, they would advise you to save more than would be optimal.
Why would they do that?
Well, how do they earn their profits? So the more you save, the more they make.
But what could possibly be wrong with saving so that you have money in your elder years?
You have less in your earlier years. I remember, actually, a case in my family of someone who lived this really, you know, everyone thought this person was really poor, never spent anything. And then after she died, they found this huge amount of money under a mattress. The point is that you can buy insurance against certain contingencies. And that turns out to be, for most of us, much more efficient than building up a reserve of wealth just in case you need it.
So you're saying spend the money on insurance.
Buy insurance. That would be far more efficient for many of us, as a society certainly, pool the risks so that not everybody has to have this huge amount of wealth. Think of it in the case of catastrophic health insurance. Imagine if every individual had to save enough wealth so that in case they got cancer, they could pay for it out of their wealth rather than out of insurance. It'd be ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, how is that different in old age? I don't ever intend to retire as long as I'm capable of working. But who knows? Maybe I'll get Alzheimer's. There are various types of insurance that I can buy.
For instance, what are some of
the long-term care insurance, for example, for assisted living. And, you know, if I have disabilities, the way long-term care insurance works is it kicks in and
right.
We'll pay for home health care, we'll pay for assistance. And
right. So you don't have to, as we've heard the stories and lived some of the stories, spend down all of your assets, spend down the worth of your house so that you can qualify for, let's say, state-funded care.
Well, that's right. And often, you know, the state-funded care isn't the best care. I mean, you don't want to wind up in some of those nursing homes.
We want to move to other things, but just, you know, you will hear from people who say, I was fully insured and still the insurance wouldn't cover certain things, a length of stay or something like that for my parent or something.
Well,
like
this
that.
Brings us to another point, which is a lot of my friends are finding that not only are they not going to get an inheritance, but their parents are depending on them. In other words, we insure our parents are insuring us. You know, a lot of elderly leave money not because they intended to leave an inheritance, but because, you know, they died earlier than they thought. So you get an inheritance because your parents didn't live very long. The other side of that is, suppose they live way long. Well, not only you're not going to get an inheritance, you're going to have to pay to help support them.
But it still strikes fear in the heart when you are, yes, taking care of a parent and filled with joy to be able to do it, but you're spending your own money. And so how do boomers long-term protect themselves? Is it simply to make sure you've bought enough protection, you've spent money in your 50s and 60s to protect you in your older age?
Well, yes, that's part of it. But let me give you another example. We tend to think in narrow categories, and in part it's because we're, you know, bombarded with all this advertising about saving in conventional ways. But one way to protect yourself against income inadequacy in your old age is to upgrade your skills all the time, to invest in your own ability to earn a living, even after, you know, as time goes on.
And one way to do that, spend money on retraining.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now, that's an investment. Economists call this investing in human capital. There's lots of evidence to show that for many people, that is by far and away the highest return kind of investment.
You said that you intend to work forever, and so you might be a candidate for that. But what about the person who says, I don't want to work forever. I am someone who doesn't like their job, who doesn't enjoy their work, maybe backbreaking work, and they want to retire.
Well, again, different people have different tastes.
Are they going to be allowed to have different tastes, or is society really going to demand that they do work?
You know, again, economists look at this as, look at retirement as buying leisure. Okay, that's one of the things you can buy with your money, is leisure. If you can't afford it, just like you can't afford a Cadillac or you can't afford a yacht, then you can't afford it. So you can't afford not to work, right? That's a reality. One of the things that you can do to protect yourself against that is train for alternative employment that isn't as distasteful to you. That's all I'm pointing out. Now, can everyone do this? No, certainly not. Not everyone can, but many can.
Do you think we're going to see a world where, you know, society is open to hiring people in the 70s and 80s?
We're seeing it already. All you have to do, you know, my mother lives in Boca Raton, Florida. She's 94 years old. I have an aunt who's also 94 and is still working.
Really? Where? Doing
Absolutely.
What? Doing what?
She works for an educational games company, and she assembles these games that are made out of wood. She doesn't work many hours,
right.
You know, a few hours, a couple of days a week, and she loves it.
That brings us to Social Security. By 2012, about 20% of the workforce will be 55 or older. Many Americans rely on Social Security, never mind savings. You know, this is what they think is going to be their help in the future. Projections show that if something isn't done to change the system, Social Security is going to go bankrupt. You say that's not going to happen. Why not?
Well, because we're going to make changes. Why is the retirement age fixed? I mean, we've already made some adjustments. So, for example, I'm now 63. I won't qualify for full Social Security benefits till age 67. It's gone up.
Right.
And that's going to continue to happen.
Do you think that the system will be changed so that someone who does have substantial amount of money, that, you know, small percentage of Americans that is very, very wealthy, I'm talking millions and millions and millions, do you think in any way it'll be changed so that
has been changed. There was a time not all that long ago when Social Security benefits were not taxable. Then they became half taxable. Eventually, they'll become fully taxable. And if we have progressive tax rates, you know, people who are in the upper brackets are going to wind up getting very little.
Professor Zvi Bodhi is finance and economics professor at Boston University. We've been talking retirement, and he's far from it. Zvi, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And a reminder, still to come, will video kill the radio star? That's the question for Ira Glass when our program continues. My terrible Ira Glass imitation there. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, Sirius and XM, the satellite radio services, officially confirmed today that they have agreed to merge. To understand what this proposed merger means for the broadcast industry and listeners, we're joined by Hiawatha Bray, technology reporter for the Boston Globe. And Hiawatha, these were serious competitors, so why did they want to merge?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that they merged because they're fighting over what is still a very small audience, and they are spending hellacious amounts of money in an effort to win those audiences. For example, you had Sirius paying $500 million for an exclusive contract with one guy, Howard Stern. You had XM paying more than that, like about $650 million for an exclusive contract with Major League Baseball, and so on. The stuff that they want and need to attract these audiences are hugely expensive, and we haven't even talked about the cost of launching these. I think they cost like about $500 million apiece, each satellite that they launch, and each of them has like about four satellites in geosynchronous orbit over the Earth.
So it's a lot of money that's been shelled out, and we should say we were saying they've merged, but they, you know, they really haven't yet. It has to be signed off on. How's that expected to go?
Well, the consensus from what I'm hearing is that this is liable to be a very rough patch for them. I don't know if anybody here remembers, but the company that owns the satellite TV service, Dish Network, wanted to merge with DirecTV back around 2002. And after months of wrangling, the federal government said, forget about it, because then there'll only be one satellite TV offering out there, and we think that's a monopoly, and we think that's dangerous.
Right. Antitrust regulators will not be happy with this. But on their side, the satellite companies, XM and Sirius, say, well, wait a minute, we have to compete with iPods and with HD radio and all this other stuff, so it's still competitive.
Well, that's their argument, and actually there is some merit to that argument, I think, especially if you consider, for example, the rise of HD radio. I mean, HD radio has just taken off, so a lot of people don't really understand the full potential of it. But what they're doing is that by digitizing the signal, and this is similar to what they're doing with digital TV, as soon as you digitize the signal, you can take the same frequency, and now instead of broadcasting one signal on it, you could broadcast three or four. And a lot of these radio stations are planning on running on their same single chunk of bandwidth. They might be running three or four different radio stations. And so, at least in theory, the number of choices available to the terrestrial free radio listener is about to grow substantially. And they're saying, look, you know, this is a different world, and just us being one satellite provider doesn't mean we're going to go out and jack up our prices, because we're going to be competing against a whole host of companies that are offering more and better services, and we can't afford to just tick off our customers by charging more.
Well, the debate is going to continue as to whether or not XM and Sirius can actually do this. But in the meantime, if they do, what does it mean for all those listeners who went out and bought their own XM or Sirius radio?
No, it's better than that. What does it mean for all the listeners who've gone out and bought their own cars?
Oh, that's
one
right.
of the biggest distribution points, in fact, I believe the biggest distribution point for satellite radio, is the deals they've done with the auto industry. In fact, GM and Honda are going to be on the board of this company if the deal is allowed to go through. Cars are their biggest distribution point. But right now, if you've bought a car with satellite radio, it's either Sirius or XM. How they're going to work that out is going to be a really fun thing to see. There are a bunch of things they could do. They could take some Sirius programming and put them on the XM satellites and vice versa. Once they're, you know, all one big happy family, there's nothing to stop them from doing that.
So all of these questions remain, but as you said, one of the reasons they had to merge is that they were spending so much money, they've got to stop the bloodletting. Does this mean they'll be cutting programs like, say, perhaps Here and Now, XM Radio, PR, Channel 133?
You're first on their list. No, seriously, though, that is very likely to happen, but we don't know who and we don't know where. I just got an email. Somebody in the hip-hop news service was pointing out that this could raise some very interesting questions, because there are, like, major hip-hop artists who have deals with either XM or with Sirius. And so now they're going to have to sort out which of these shows stay, which of them go. I mean, Eminem, Grandmaster Flash, 50 Cent are on Sirius. Snoop Dogg, Ludacris, Trick Daddy, they're on XM. Are they going to keep all those shows? Who knows?
We'll be listening in to find out. And so there we are, Here and Now, right up with Trick Daddy on XM.
There you go.
Although we're on XMPR, Channel 133. Catch it while you can. Hiawatha, thanks.
You're welcome.
We'll plug there. Hiawatha Bray, technology reporter for the Boston Globe. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So Ira Glass is here. You know, he's host of the wildly popular public radio storytelling show, This American Life. It's the show where people just tell stories.
I was talking to a first grader about libraries, and I suddenly found myself talking about bullies. That's the thing about the idea of bullies. The idea is so powerful that it can derail any conversation and pull it towards its own orbit.
Stories that make you close your eyes and just picture them yourself without, you know, pictures. Which is why some of Ira Glass's many fans are a little nervous, because in addition to This American Life on radio, Ira Glass is now, some would say, crossing over to the dark side with a new television program on cable Showtime. So we thought we'd check in to see how he's doing. Ira, hello.
Hello.
Well, I must say, people who go the other way, and I am one, television to radio, do fall in love with sound. But when Showtime first approached you, did you worry about whether you would fall in love with pictures?
I didn't worry that we'd fall in love with pictures, actually. We simply worried that it would suck. You know? Like, we really had no idea, like, how it could be done. And truthfully, like, for the first year of them talking to us, we were very skeptical that it could be done well.
Ira, I'm sorry. Do you mind? Could you just hold up 1 second? I'm sorry.
Sure.
Okay, there. I feel better now. I continue. You were telling us about your feelings about pictures. See, here's the thing.
Without music underneath me, I feel like I can't even talk.
Not just music, but Philip Glass, your cousin.
Yeah.
I have Koi on a Squatsy as well. You know, and there's just something about, you know, those were the only two elements. It was, you know, some sort of driving music and people's voices. So how's it going?
With the radio show, you know, if you hear it for 10 seconds, you can tell it's us. You can tell it could be nobody else. And we wanted the television show to have that same feeling. And no thanks to me, the director and the cinematographer created a look for the thing and a feeling for the thing that, like, it looks like nothing else on TV. And I feel like they came up with something that was actually original and new.
Well, in fact, we want to listen. This is a story of Ralph Fisher. He's the rancher who owned Chance the Bull, many listeners will remember. And after Chance died, he'd become like a family member. Ralph then had Chance cloned, and that produced Second Chance.
Yes.
And here we have a scene where Ralph Fisher, the rancher, is in his hospital bed after being gored by Second Chance, who he hoped was going to be, you know, another beloved family pet. Someone has given Ralph a little toy rocking horse. Let's listen.
Sandra, hand me that horse, would you? How does he work? Wait. That's how I feel right now. You know, I'm going to walk out of here tomorrow, the next day, and I'll go right back out there and give him another bucket of feed. I mean, that's what you have to do.
The thing that you don't see until you see the video footage is that at the end of that brave little speech, you know, I'm going to get out there and all, is he gets this look in his face, like this wave of feeling just crosses his face, where suddenly he just looks totally weary, like, oh, he looks so beat. This was the first story that we shot for the pilot, and when we were putting it together, I saw this footage, and I remember seeing it and just thinking, like, wow, it had not occurred to me that seeing the person could actually add to the story. Which, in retrospect, is really stupid if you think about the entire history of cinema. Like I just thought, like, well, we'll do these stories and it'll be fun. We'll have pictures and the pictures will have a feeling. And for me, I always felt like the power of a quote actually came from the fact that the person was invisible. The thought had never crossed my mind that if you saw their face, that their face might do something that would convey so much feeling.
So it sounds like you're falling in love with the thing that you know, documentary filmmakers live for, which is for someone to have a real moment on their face. I mean, has that been hard? Because often cameras can change things.
Cameras can change things. And truthfully, like, the amount of gear and people and all can be a little daunting. And, like, one thing that I didn't know about, again, this is, like, so naive. You sit so far away from the person. There's, like, on the radio, you know, you sit right next to them and you hold up a microphone to their mouth.
It's
and
intimate.
It's just like you're sitting at the kitchen table. Right, yeah. But as it turns out, as on the radio, if you just get somebody talking about something that means a lot to them, most people will actually just kind of forget the gear enough to actually have a real conversation, and you can get somewhere.
Well, and at one point it got perhaps too intimate for a camera. We've mentioned that Ralph Fisher was gored, and your cameras were there when this second bull did gore him. You didn't use the footage in the television show, but you did use it on the radio program. Let's listen to your producer, Jane Feltes, obviously shaken, talking about what had happened when she was in there with the camera.
I screamed, and I didn't want to look at it because I thought he was going to, like, kill him, you know, and I didn't want...
And what did you see?
Like, I just saw him, like, fly up in the air, and then the bullet was loud. It seemed really loud because it was at the corner of the fence. So he threw him up in the air, and he landed, like, on the corners of the fences, and he's ramming him in the ground into the fence. So the fences are all shaking, and the bull's making all the noises. And it seems like the bull's going to break through the fences after he's done killing him. You know what I mean?
If this had been, I'm not going to name names, Dateline, I guess I am. This would have been a promo played over and over again, and it would have been in the program. Why did it work for radio and not for television? Is it just as simple as, you know, the image was too much?
No, like honestly, on the radio, Jane is like somebody, she's sort of like anybody, you know what I mean? Like, you hear all the emotion in her voice, and that's all you hear. Whereas if you were to actually see the video footage, you'd see that, okay, we're in the middle of Texas, but she's this, like, a cute 20-something from Chicago with a nose ring and streaks in her hair. And like, honestly, she looks so out of place. And when you see her, you just think, like, what are these people doing in Texas pestering these nice, like, ranchers? Mm-hmm. Like, it just – it signifies so randomly. And honestly, it's distracting.
You know the anthem of the MTV generation, Video Killed the Radio Star?
Yes.
Your many fans are hoping that doesn't happen to you, but apparently – it at least happened to your ears. Here's a scene where you're talking with director Chris Wilcha about getting your ears taped back.
So we're here in Utah, and this
you're
is
getting your ears taped.
I'm getting the back of my ears taped. The light apparently is coming through my ears, making them glow pretty, and we don't want them to glow pretty.
You fell for that? I never heard of that. Really? So they taped them so that no light would come through them?
Yeah. Yeah, apparently this is a standard cinematography problem, they say.
I never.
Or alternately, a very elaborate prank.
Right on you. Well, you recently moved to New York, set up an office there. You're doing this. I mean, it's the real deal. But as you well know, some people back home in Chicago were taken aback by that because they have a sense of this American life that it comes from a certain place, and that place is the heart of the country, you know, not those whatever on the coast. You know, do you worry about that?
I would probably be a better person if I would worry about that, but no, I don't worry about that at all. I never, ever think about it.
What would you say to the public radio listeners who are very proud of the fact that they don't own a TV?
I mean, I myself didn't have a TV for 15 years, so I understand the sentiment. And then I got a TV during the first season of The Sopranos, which is now, I guess, 5 or 6 years ago, because I'd heard that there's this amazing thing happening on television that suddenly it became good. There's a lot. I mean, it's funny. We're going through a weird golden age of television. And in any given week, there's a half dozen actually kind of great shows on.
And Ira Glass has jumped into the pool. He's host of This American Life on Public Radio International, which is coming to Showtime TV next month. To promote that launch, This American Life is on its first national tour in 4 years. So for more about that tour, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, Ira Glass, again, host of This American Life. This is my personal favorite, Koyaanisqatsi. You don't hear this enough under stories, Ira. See if you can work it in.
All right, we'll do.
Ira, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Come on, don't you love how he plays Philip Glass and everything? Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.